Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The New York Attorney General is investigating the Trump Organization, and the Trump family is dragging their feet every step of the way.
What the Trump Organization has learned over the years, dating back way before Trump became president, is that it pays to stonewall in court cases.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 25th, a look at the steps the Attorney General is taking and what it could mean in the lead-up to November. Also, a look at how Democrats are approaching gun violence in this election cycle.
In terms of differences between Harris and Biden, there's really very little. But of course, when you compare either one or both of them to President Trump or Vice President Mike Pence, there's a pretty big gulf there.
But first, an update on Breonna Taylor's case and the public pressure to take action against the police officers who killed her. Let's get started. Those are protesters chanting Breonna Taylor's name in downtown Louisville, Kentucky. It's been more than 5 months since Louisville police served a no-knock warrant at Breonna Taylor's home and shot the 26-year-old EMT to death. The officers involved in her killing have yet to face charges, and only one has been fired. The incident was an example of a pattern of systemic racism and police violence that have spurred protests against racial violence. Those protests continued this week in the wake of the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. But Breonna Taylor's name has since become a rallying cry in the streets and on social media in the fight against police brutality. On Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, calls to hashtag say her name and, quote, arrest the cops who killed Breonna Taylor have become widespread, with her face across smartphone screens and her name invoked in memeified catchphrases. And Breonna's likeness hasn't just been immortalized online. Offline, her death has inspired countless murals in Louisville and across the country. Celebrities like Oprah Winfrey have added to mounting pressure on officials by commissioning 26 billboards throughout Louisville demanding justice. And publications like O Magazine and Vanity Fair have featured Breonna on their covers. This weekend even marked the start of so-called BreonnaCon in Louisville, a series of events to continue to raise awareness about the killing and lack of accountability. But despite all this attention, legal justice for Breonna Taylor has remained elusive. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining me now are Philip M. Bailey, a national political correspondent for USA Today and the host of States of America podcast. And Alyssa Richardson is an assistant professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism and the author of Bearing Witness While Black. Philip, Alyssa, thanks to you both for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Tandina.
Philip, let's start with you. Why haven't the police officers involved in Breonna Taylor's killing been charged yet?
Right. Well, March 13th is when Breonna Taylor is shot and killed in a police raid in her South End Louisville apartment. Her, along with her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, were in that apartment. She was fatally shot. At least three officers, Brent Hankinson, Sergeant John Mattingly, and Officer Cosgrove, have been identified as the main officers involved. Really, I mean, it comes down to an issue of how this case was handled initially and how it was handed off. The Attorney General's office, Daniel Cameron, Republican, and Democratic Mayor Greg Fisher's office had a bit of a disagreement over information being shared from the Public Integrity Unit to the Attorney General's office, the AG's office, saying we don't have all the information yet. Then saying, okay, we have all the information, but some of this information needs to be redone with ballistics and other information, of course, that has been sort of farmed out to the FBI. That's mainly what Attorney General Daniel Cameron's office has said thus far, is that a lot of that information, ballistics, is still being tested out in Quantico in Washington by the Federal Bureau of Investigations. But there certainly has been, that has been part of the frustration from protesters and Taylor's family, is that she is killed on March 13th, and here we are in August, and we still don't have the complete investigation. Part of it was COVID. Right. I mean, right when this happened, it was when the lockdown across the U.S. was beginning to happen in places like Louisville, where we were all beginning to be told to shelter in place. But some of this, I think, certainly is the attention and the scrutiny on the case has made it to where all involved want to make sure they get this absolutely right. But there certainly is a feeling that this is being done deliberately by protesters and her family.
Alyssa, we mentioned at the top of the segment here that there has been a lot of activism around Breonna Taylor's case in particular. This was a case that was initially, you know, not very widely known, and now it has really taken on epic proportions in terms of what activists are looking for. How would you characterize the activism that we've seen during the past 5 months?
I think this activism is unprecedented for a woman victim, Tanzina. I think that since the Say Her Name movement began in 2015, one of the key criticisms of the activism, or shall I say lack of activism, that really surrounds or swells up when women are the victims of police brutality is central here. I think when Sandra Bland died, we didn't have immediately any video, for example, in 2015 that showed what happened. And many people did not know what happened in that situation and said, well, if we don't have any visuals, how can we rally around this case? But it really wasn't that we didn't have visuals. It's that we didn't have a cultural script at first for really caring about Black women in this country. For example, Trayvon Martin died without video, but we immediately rallied around the family, as we should have, and made sure that they had the support that they needed from all the activists from all corners of the country. And his death really galvanized the Black Lives Matter movement in ways that we hadn't seen before. So when Sandra Bland died and people were really upset with the lack of coverage that she received and the Say Her Name movement sprang up, we then got a new cultural script about how to care about Black women, whether there was video or not. And now it has led to this case where Breonna Taylor, unfortunately, we have the template through Sandra Bland of how we galvanize around Black women being killed by police. Again, there's no video, and we don't need it in this case. We just believe Kenneth Walker. We believe that something horrible happened that day, and that this is a case that we have a chance to really make a difference in how we show up for Black women in this country and how we use smartphones and social media to tell different stories about not only their demise, but how we stood up for them in this moment.
You know, Philip, there's also been some backlash to an event in Louisville called Breonna Con that's supposed to be taking place this week. What do we know about who's organizing that event, and how is it being received by residents of Louisville and activists who have been on the ground in Louisville since Breonna Taylor's killing?
Right. Breonna Con is an event over the weekend and up until this week. I think they're also planning some major protests on Tuesday. Being organized by Until Freedom, a national social justice group that is led by Tamika Mallory, a well-known, nationally known activist, and a lot of different celebrities, you know, from shows like Real Housewives of Atlanta, you know, Love and Hip Hop, etc. But really trying to sort of bring the sort of national attention to Louisville. Tamika Mallory, for example, has been living in Louisville for a few weeks now, sort of, you know, these different protests. You see a mix of different things. Some of this thing called a BBQ. I went out there on Sunday just to sort of witness and see what was going on. The feeling from some local activists, not all, but many, is that, look, we are on the front lines of this. We're the ones been tear gassed, pepper sprayed, and these national folks are coming in really doing, sort of trying to turn this into Essence Festival, right? Like trying to turn this into a party. Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, she's been at some of these events and signed on to and co-signed it, saying she doesn't want her daughter to be remembered just as someone who died or was killed by police. So there's a bit of tension in Louisville over this amongst different activists, some who say this is a fine event. It's certainly anytime Black people occupy a space, right, with these rise of these Karen events where white people are calling the police for people, Black people barbecuing or just sitting outside, that by itself is an act of protest. There are others, though, who point out that this is commodification of Breonna Taylor, right? It's this memification of her, whether or not it's meant to be good or not. You're basically turning her into a hashtag only. You're only turning her into this commodity. And I think that criticism is one that people need to pay attention to, because it reminds me very much of Dr. Martin Luther King and his children sort of advertising him and using him through McDonald's. However, on the more substantive end of that, let's look at Emmett Till, whose mother back in the 1950s decided to have an open casket. She was certainly using her son's pulverized body as a PR to draw attention to Jim Crow violence and white supremacy in the South of the 1950s and 60s. And this has always been an issue with Black Death. Do you use this event as a campaign, a rallying cry? At the same time, by doing that, you do sort of commercialize this individual, this loved one of yours. And the first people who have say-so in that often are the loved one's family. But there are many activists, both here in Louisville and nationally, who feel that Breonna Khan and these events sort of turned her into a thing and a commodity to idolize or even to make money off of rather than a social justice movement. But there are those who attended the BBQ who told me, look, not everyone's going to get involved in a protest where they're going to be arrested or blocking traffic. People, you need to let people participate how they're going to participate. So that's certainly a debate that's been brought to as a result of these events.
I think it's a fascinating debate, and I think social media is playing a big role in that. Alyssa, what are your thoughts on the memification, if you will, of the way Philip described it, of what's happening with Breonna Taylor's case, her likeness, her image, the hashtag? How do we strike a balance, if you will, between drawing attention to the cause and not turning it into a commodity or trivial or risking trivializing it even?
That's a great question. I think we have to remember two things. The first thing is that the initial kind of draw or power of Black Twitter was that it could turn on its face a racist incident and really criticize it and really critique it through biting humor. And initially, that satire is what brought down Paula Deen's empire, for example. It has really, in internet parlance, dragged many celebrities and created this cancel culture, if you will, that has made many people very scared in some instances to make false moves lest they awaken that sleeping giant. And it's become a powerful force in righting the wrongs of many social things that would have gone under the rug, as Philip mentioned, these Karenisms or people calling the police on folks doing ordinary things are really the work of Black Twitter, pointing those things out through memes and hashtags like Karen's Gone Wild. But when we see them applied toward a singular figure, toward Breonna Taylor in this instance, many people balk at that, and they are saying because it's not done in the same fashion with the same Black Twitter originators in mind, and we see people from all walks of life memifying her, that's when it becomes a question of where is the true intention. And I think a lot of people right now are witnessing the actual messiness of protest. And I think that smartphones and social media have done an incredible job of letting us see in real time what protest looks like. We have a real habit of romanticizing, for example, the civil rights movement and really pointing out the charismatic Black male leaders that were during that time. But we don't really pay attention to the fact that there were so many organizations working under that umbrella, whether it was SCLC, NAACP, SNCC, CORE, and eventually the Black Power movement. There were so many different groups competing for the right way forward, and they didn't always agree. And so now on social media, we can see all of these groups hashing out their discussions, their debates, their suggestions for what should happen next. And that is happening alongside, and many times, non-Black audiences who are trying to find a way to identify and help. And that creates that messiness that we're seeing right now. So the balance, to go back to your original question, must come from the people who are closest to the family. And they must endorse these messages themselves.
You know, in March was when Breonna Taylor was killed. The police officers involved in her shooting have yet to be charged. What are we expecting to see play out in Louisville in the coming weeks regarding the legal aspect of this case?
Everyone's eyes are on Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who is speaking at the Republican National Committee Convention this week. A protege of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the first African-American attorney general in Kentucky's history. This is going to be a defining moment of his career, as many assume that he is being groomed to be U.S. Senator at one point. He has run heavily on his relationship with law enforcement. He has buddied up with President Donald Trump and spoke at his roundtable on police issues, mainly speaking towards respecting police officers. So there's a lot of attention on what his office will decide with all three of these officers' cases in his office. There is certainly a preparation here in Louisville for the worst. You see businesses boarded up. You see folks really in apprehension, understanding that there could be possible violence if these officers are not charged. I think Daniel Cameron has certainly kept his focus, though, on the case and tried not to, despite efforts by activists and others to put pressure on him and protesting at his home, occupying his front yard, trying not to, you know, give any wink or nod one way or the other. But there certainly is an anxiety in Louisville over what this case will be and how people will react to it.
And you, I imagine you've been in touch with the family. What are their expectations as far as how this will go?
Well, Breonna Taylor's family attorneys, including Benjamin Crump, believe that these officers absolutely should be charged. And they are confident, from the attorneys I've spoken with for Breonna Taylor's family, they believe all three officers will be and should be charged. There has been discussion and debate and rumors about only one of the officers will be charged. That would be Brent Hankinson, the officer who's already been fired by Louisville police. You know, the idea that he was the most reckless of the three because he was shooting inside the apartment really without seeing what he was shooting at. If you look at some of the PIU investigation materials that have at least been made public, some of the interviews, I believe Sergeant Mattingly says in the interview with internal affairs investigators, saying how Officer Hankinson was just sort of charged up, that he sort of, you know, was maybe a little too amped before they bursted through the doors. But there is speculation, at least a hope on the part of Breonna Taylor's family attorneys, that all three will be charged, that you have to charge all three as a group. There's also this question, though, about the other officers who were there, right, who may have been wearing body cameras or not. Were those body cameras on? What does that information, what do those videos show? And there still is this persistent effort by police and by those who support police in Louisville to point out information about Breonna Taylor and her involvement with the suspected drug dealer, DeMarquez Glover. More information is beginning to be leaked out, probably by police department informants or sources, to the Courier-Journal, my old outfit, about Taylor's involvement, her relationship to Glover, who was seen entering and exiting her home, her apartment. I think there are new jail recordings that have been made, at least released or found out by the Courier, where Glover is mentioning Breonna Taylor and her name. And this comes down, I think, to the issue and the debate over how we police in African-American communities and how we police in general. Who is seen as someone who is worthy of having their day in court, and who is seen as someone who is an immediate threat who needs to be put down because they're not obeying or listening to officers, or even if they are, in the confusion and these tense situations between African-Americans and patrol officers. And this is what I think that the Fund the Police movement is really trying to get to, more than just shifting resources away from police departments into more social programs, mental health, etc., but how police respond and how they behave with certain people versus others. We've certainly seen videos and body cam footage of officers shooting African-American suspects, saying they felt in danger for their life. Supporters of police saying, look, these people weren't cooperating, weren't complying with police. Or, you know, if you're involved in any sort of criminal activity, there are consequences, you know, language like that. But then you also see videos of white individuals acting very, let's just say, uncooperative with police, and them not being killed, right? And these mild encounters with officers, even our local prosecutor here saying that just because you were involved in drugs doesn't mean you should be executed and killed by police.
Well, so I mean, we're beginning to see think it. About that, I think about right. Dylan Roof, for example, who was taken alive by right. Law enforcement after killing, right. you know, what was it, 9 people in a church. I mean, there is a huge discrepancy, I think, in what we're witnessing with how black and white people are treated by police, for sure.
And that is the shift in the conversation you haven't seen in previous decades or years, which is there's always been this respectability politics, so that the perfect victim needed to be shot or killed by police in order for people to rally around that and cry out for reforms or change. What's happened, I think, since then is that people are saying, no, the person doesn't have to be perfect. Why do police act this way in this community with these individuals, regardless of what they're accused of doing or how they're behaving, but not with others who are accused or have been claimed to have behaved in very heinous ways as well. So that's the debate we're seeing that shifts, and I think that's why there's such a fracture, but not only in the between the two political parties, but between communities and within African American communities as well. Right, this idea of who's respectable, who should be treated this way, who shouldn't be treated this way, how should you behave with police?
Philip Bailey is a correspondent for USA Today, and Alyssa Richardson is an assistant professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tandina.
No problem. Thank you.
As the 2020 campaigns ramp up, the debate over gun policy may play a role in what we see on the debate stage in the coming weeks. So today we're going to take a look at the Democrats' approach to gun policy on the heels of last week's Democratic National Convention, and specifically what we've seen from Kamala Harris in her career so far, and how it fits in with what we've seen from Joe Biden. Jason DeBruin is with me. He's a reporter for North Carolina Public Radio, and he's with the Guns and America Reporting Project. Jason, thanks for being with me.
Hi, good to chat with you.
So the Democratic National Convention, while virtual this year, still had lots of areas of importance. Give us a summary of what we heard during the DNC in terms of gun control reform and gun violence.
So we actually heard a good amount. It actually took center stage on one of the evenings. There was a full 10-minute montage of videos and speeches on gun safety. These were pre-recorded, but they included people like Emma Gonzalez, who was a survivor of the Parkland shooting. Certainly groups like Moms Demand Action, they had a prominent role. Obviously, Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman, who of course has been a big advocate for gun safety measures. She also prominently spoke. So it's something where Democrats, it looks like, are trying to make a bigger issue of this year. And that's sort of interesting because in previous elections, it's always been one of those things where there are certain Republican voters who will see gun issues as their like single issue, that it's what drives them to the polls. It's what drives them to, say, volunteer or perhaps even donate. Haven't seen that as much on the Democratic side. And so it'll be interesting to see if that picks up a little bit in this election.
Let's talk about the candidates specifically. I mean, let's start with Senator Harris, the vice presidential candidate. What do we know about her track record as AG at California and senator in California that gives us her a sense of how she approaches dealing with guns and gun reform?
Yeah, it's a good question. She's definitely tough on guns. I mean, she's tough on all crime, right? I mean, she even gets some criticism, I think, on the left for perhaps being too tough on crime. Just as a for instance, in 2011, an operation that she sort of spearheaded while she was attorney general seized about 1,200 firearms from people who were barred from owning them. These were people who were largely mentally unstable or perhaps had active restraining orders against them. Interestingly, she actually got some credit for that particular action from some gun rights groups. You know, they would like to see the laws. You know, there are certainly some laws that groups like the NRA support, and when attorneys general enforce those laws, they do tend to at least give some credit. Now, to be clear, the NRA has given Senator Harris and vice presidential candidate Harris an F, so it's not like anyone who is a gun rights activist sees her as a, quote, friend to gun owners or anything of that nature. So she's certainly one of the people who would look to enact some more some stricter gun regulations.
What do we know about presidential nominee Joe Biden and how he talked about guns during his campaign, if at all?
You know, pretty similar. I think it's probably fair to say that Senator Harris is perhaps it's a bigger issue for her. But look, there's no question that Joe Biden would also be an advocate of stricter gun measures. You know, while he was vice president, President Obama actually placed him on a task force to try to enact some common sense gun measures, as they called it. Now, very few, if any, of those actually passed. That is due largely to the fact that the executive branch needs Congress to act on many of these issues. But it certainly has been something that's been on the forefront of candidate Biden's mind for some time.
If you were to compare Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and how they approach gun reform, who would you say is sort of, you know, where would you put them side by side?
You know, the truth is there's really not much difference between them. And that's actually true of a lot of the Democratic candidates, you know, even when there was, you know, a dozen or more that were still running. The truth is that gun issues are perhaps the most polarizing issue in American politics. We see this from Pew at time to time. There are times when other issues perhaps are more polarizing. I'm thinking back to, for instance, in 2016, the decision to build the wall was perhaps more polarizing, but gun issues are always right up there. And so there's actually very little that distinguishes one Democratic candidate from another, or for that matter, one Republican candidate from another. But of course, when you're looking at comparing Democrats to Republicans, they're really quite polarized, or they're really quite different on the issues. So in terms of differences between Harris and Biden, there's really very little. But of course, when you compare either one or both of them to President Trump or Vice President Mike Pence, there's a pretty big gulf there.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, Jason, is that there have been reports that more Americans are buying guns in light of the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. Given that that is happening, at least in some parts of the country, we know even here in New York that there are requests to get permits that have been increasing. You know, is this an issue that's still going to resonate with Democratic voters and perhaps disenchanted Republican voters as much as the Democrats hope it will?
I think yes, because of what I said just a minute ago about it being so polarizing. I would imagine that it's maybe not the most important thing this year. I mean, we have the pandemic, right? We have social unrest, and we have focus on police brutality and injustice and inequality overall. Clearly, those are very important issues as well. You know, the other interesting thing to mention is that gun issues tend to percolate around school shootings. And with the pandemic and schools being out, we actually haven't had nearly as many school shootings. Sort of an interesting little data point for you. March of 2020 was the first month since March of 2002 that there was not a school shooting. So for many, many months in a row, there had been a school shooting. And that's when, you know, these issues tend to percolate up. Of course, now there's other, you know, equally or perhaps even more important issues that are all around us. But again, that's not to say that gun issues won't be important. Groups like Every Town for Gun Safety and Moms Demand Action have pledged to spend tens of millions of dollars on campaigns, not only at the presidential level, but at you know, for Senate candidates as well, including right here in North Carolina. So I definitely think that it's going to be a big issue, if not perhaps the biggest issue, if that makes sense.
What about when it comes, we talked about school shootings, but there also have been increases and spikes this summer in particular in gun violence. What do we know about that? I mean, that sort of, you know, flies directly alongside calls to, quote unquote, defund the police. And I'm wondering how, you know, and really siphon off resources from police departments to more community-based solutions. Do you see that either of the candidates have taken a position there on how exactly that would play out, given the activist demands?
Yeah, that maybe that still has yet to play out as well. But, you know, you hit on some important things. There has been an enormous spike in gun sales, and we've seen that have an effect on gun violence. You know, maybe again, one thing to point out, 2/3 of all gun-related deaths are actually suicides. And so we perhaps won't know the true full effect of this increase in gun sales for several more months or years. Reporting on suicides tends to lag several months or even more in some cases. And so we might not know the full effect of this big increase in gun sales for some time. But you know, even taking suicides sort of and putting that aside, we are seeing increases not only in homicides, but also just in everyday gun violence. That's attributable, you know, partly to pandemic stresses that people are feeling, partly to stresses and perhaps fear of the, you know, social unrest that's happening around people. And certainly just with the increased availability of firearms. I mean, there's a lot of research to show that, you know, in any area, in a household or in a neighborhood, as the percentage of people who own guns increase, the percentages of firearm violence increases in those places. And so the prevalence, or the more people that own guns, The research is pretty clear that that does increase gun violence, both on the suicide and on the interpersonal levels.
The NRA has been struggling for a while now in terms of its internal politics, in terms of investigations that have been lobbed against it. And I'm wondering how you mentioned earlier that both Harris and Biden have very low ranking within the NRA, which I'm sure their voters don't have a real issue with, if you will. But tell us a little bit about the investigation and how strong you suspect or not strong you suspect the NRA will be able to be and to sort of counter some of this, the ads that you mentioned, for example, that might be coming from Everytown USA.
Yeah, I would think they would certainly be muted this year. I mean, it's funny you mentioned that the voters perhaps wouldn't mind so much if Biden or Harris had Fs from the NRA. And in fact, in some campaign speeches, they actually tout that. You know, they're proud of the fact that the NRA does not think highly of them. But yeah, you know, one of the biggest issues for the NRA this campaign cycle might just simply be that it doesn't have nearly the same war chest to work with as it has in the past. You know, they're being investigated for misappropriating funds, where the heads of the organization were essentially taking lavish trips and even, you know, siphoning off donations from the very members that they purport to serve or to advocate for. But at the end of the day, it is still going to be interesting if they're able to, for instance, say to their donors, say to their members, look, this is all liberal media. This is all bias. You know, you can't believe what the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, you can't believe what any of them are saying. You trust me. You trust us. We say that we're doing the best for you. And we truly are. And that perhaps will still be a persuasive argument. We've not seen the NRA spend as much so far in this cycle as we have in previous cycles, and they have not made the same kinds of pledges that, as you mentioned, Everytown or Moms Demand Action has. But there still is some time in the campaign, right? I mean, they still have time to come in with a big spend, but I do suspect that they'll be a little bit more muted this year than in previous cycles, largely because of the reduction in funding that they'll have.
And I'm wondering, of course, that investigation, at least the one that I'm referring to, is coming out of New York State's Attorney General Letitia James towards the NRA. But, you know, more broadly, Jason, I'm wondering, you know, there's been lots of talk over decades now about the power of the gun lobby in Washington. If the Kamala Harris-Joe Biden ticket takes office in January, do you think that that actually would indicate that the gun lobby would eventually be taken on in the way that, you know, at least folks on that side of the political spectrum have expected?
So let me answer that in a very specific way, and it would depend on what happens in the Senate. The truth is that the executive branch really doesn't have a lot that it can do. It relies heavily on Congress, the bills that Congress can pass in order to enact gun policy or gun legislation. So even if Joe Biden wins, we'll take for granted that probably the House goes the same direction as the presidency in this election. But let's say both of those go for Democrats. That's still not a guarantee that the Senate will also go blue. And if that happens, it might be possible that there will be a lot of gun legislation that passes the House that Joe Biden is perhaps eager to sign, but that then languishes in the Senate. In fact, we're already even seeing that in the past couple of years or the past year or so, as Democrats have had control of the House, they have passed legislation that has gone nowhere, as Speaker or Senate Leader McConnell has just basically let it sit on his desk. Now, of course, in this particular situation, it is perhaps unlikely that the president would sign those pieces of legislation anyways, but nonetheless, they're not even getting to his desk. And so this is one reason that groups like Everytown and Moms Demand are taking really a two-track look. They're looking obviously at the presidential election, but they're also looking very strongly at close Senate races, including, again, here in North Carolina and other swing states, because it's very important for those groups that not only do Democrats win the executive branch, but they also take control of the Senate so that pieces of gun legislation then do not pass the House, waiting for Joe Biden to sign it, but don't ever get to his desk.
And we'll be watching. Jason DeBruin is a reporter with North Carolina Public Radio and with the Guns and America Reporting Project. Jason, thanks so much for your work.
Violent police raids on student protest encampments play out against the backdrop of a crucial presidential election.
Could this be 1968 all over again?
If every election is just like 1968, then no election is like 1968. Maybe this election is like 2024.
Plus, what Israelis are seeing on TV on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
As President Trump kicked off the first day of the Republican National Convention, the top prosecutor in New York confirmed that her office is investigating the Trump Organization. In court filings Monday, New York Attorney General Letitia James said that the civil probe concerns whether the president's business inflated the value of its assets to obtain favorable tax treatment. And the president's son, Eric Trump, sits at the very center of the dispute. Here to tell us what this all means for President Trump and the Trump Organization is David Enrich, business investigations editor at the New York Times, and the author of Dark Towers, about Donald Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we know Attorney General Letitia James has had her eyes set on the Trump administration for a while. What did we know about this investigation before this week?
Well, we knew that Tish James was very interested in the way that the Trump Organization was valuing its assets. Ever since Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer, testified before Congress last year that Trump routinely inflated the value of his assets with banks and others to try and just make more money for himself, there have been a number of investigations. And Tish James last year sent subpoenas to a number of entities, including Deutsche Bank, which is the president's longtime lender, seeking information about this. And so that happened, and then things kind of went quiet. And there have been so many investigations swirling around the president and his kids and the Trump Organization over the last year or so that it's easy to forget which ones are still outstanding. And I think a lot of people kind of took their eyes off of Letitia James and either figured that the investigation was over or that it was stalled or that it just wasn't happening. And so the news that it not only is still going on, but is active and that she is really fighting to get cooperation from the Trump Organization, it was pretty startling news yesterday.
Help us break down what exactly the Attorney General revealed yesterday as part of her investigation.
Well, first and foremost, she revealed that the investigation is not only still ongoing, but is still very active. I mean, it looks as if she has successfully received information through subpoenas from quite a few institutions, not just Deutsche Bank, but others as well, that have allowed her to gather information that extends well beyond what Michael Cohen was testifying about back early last year. So it seems like the investigation has actually made quite a bit of progress, which, you know, given how many people have been stonewalling in some of these investigations, that in itself is notable. But the other thing that she revealed was that the Trump Organization all of a sudden has just stopped cooperating with her. And that means a number of different things. One of those is that they have refused to comply with the subpoenas that her office has issued seeking documents about a number of the Trump Organization's properties and Trump's personal properties as well. And the second thing is that Eric Trump, the president's son, who is the one who's basically running Trump's businesses while he is president, has stopped cooperating as well. And it appears that what the Trump Organization and Eric Trump are worried about, at least based on the Letitia James's court filings, is that they're worried about this going from being a civil investigation and becoming a criminal one.
And to that point, David, I mean, does the lack of cooperation, doesn't that essentially help move that process along? If they're not cooperating, doesn't that raise more eyebrows at the Attorney General's office?
My hunch is that the Attorney General's office's eyebrows are already in a pretty pronounced arched position at this point, based on what they've seen. And what the Trump Organization has learned over the years, dating back way before Trump became president, is that it pays to stonewall in court cases.
Now, we know that Michael Cohen, you mentioned Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney, is also writing a book. What do we expect to learn there?
Well, I think when Michael Cohen testified before Congress, I think it was in February of 2019, he laid out a bunch of what he said were I don't want to use the word crimes because I don't think he was that specific, but he said that the Trump Organization was very manipulative and dishonest in the way it was presenting Trump's personal and business information, financial information, to a whole host of institutions, whether it was lenders or the IRS or other tax authorities. And what we know from Michael Cohen's book, having read the prologue to it, which is went online a couple weeks ago, there's going to be a lot more detail about exactly what was going on there and how the Trump Organization and Trump himself set out to deceive people, in at least in Michael Cohen's telling. So, I mean, I think from a prosecutor standpoint, clearly Michael Cohen has been interviewed by a lot of law enforcement authorities already. And so it's unclear to me how much, in terms of the actual criminal and civil cases against Trump and his family and his company, how much Michael Cohen's book is really likely to move the needle. From the standpoint of public opinion, it's going to really reinforce, I think, the position of a lot of people on the left that Trump is not fit for office. And, you know, who knows whether it's going to move the needle for anyone other than those on the left who already really strongly dislike the president. And this is a very polarized country right now, and people's beliefs seem to be pretty set in stone.
David, remind us again which Trump properties are the focus of this investigation, because again, it's not the president himself, it's the Trump Organization.
So what we know is that she, from the court filings yesterday, is that Letitia James is looking at Trump's property at the Seven Springs Estate in Westchester County, which is something that Trump bought for about $7 million and then suddenly claimed in filings with Deutsche Bank and others that it was worth nearly $300 million. So quite a gain on that. She's also said that she's looking at the valuation of Trump's big development in Chicago, as well as his golf club in Los Angeles and the tower that he bought in the late 1990s on Wall Street. So it's a cluster of properties that Trump has borrowed money to buy or refurbish, and that the valuations that he has assigned to those assets have been at times wildly inflated. It appears in an effort to either get more money out of banks or to affect his tax liabilities, either at a state or federal level.
And David, Trump himself never fully divested from his businesses, right?
I mean, he never really divested at all. He's claimed to not be involved in the operation of any of his businesses anymore, although his sons are the ones running it, and his sons are clearly quite close to the president and in times politically involved as well. But he divested little, if anything, of his actual assets. I mean, you can look at his annual financial disclosure forms, the most recent one, which is filed a couple weeks ago. And it is really clear that he just has this wide range of assets all over the world, that some of which are, it's clear what they are, but others are just these LLCs that are very opaque and you just can't even tell what they're holding. And so it's his business empire remains wide ranging, and the transparency around it is, you know, very limited at best.
And for some of, as you mentioned at the top of the segment here, I mean, it's been a while since we've talked about this, and some people might assume that these investigations are either not going on or have long forgotten about them. How does the New York Attorney General current investigation relate to other inquiries into the Trump Organization? I mean, there were other inquiries from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, for example.
Yeah, and the main difference between those two investigations is that the Attorney General's investigation, at least right now, is a civil investigation, not a criminal one, whereas the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation is a criminal one. And the DA's investigation is, and it appears to be looking at a lot of the same things that the Attorney General's investigation is looking at. The bottom line, though, is that we just do not know the full scope of either of these investigations. What we know about them is limited to what has come out in court filings very recently. And the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, his office has fought with Trump to get his tax returns over the past year. And that's a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court sided with Cy Vance and kind of affirmed his authority to conduct a criminal investigation into the president. But Cy Vance's office is still fighting with Trump and with Trump's accounting firm, Mazars, to get the president's tax returns, which could be very important in a case that is trying to prove that there was some sort of fraud committed by the president or his company to reduce their tax bills or overstate their asset values. And
you said the magic word, David, taxes. I mean, the president took these efforts to shield his tax returns all the way to the Supreme Court. I mean, do we expect the AG, the New York AG's investigation is going to follow a similar path?
That's a good question, and I don't know. I mean, clearly she doesn't seem to have yet. And the reason I say that is because whenever someone subpoenas Trump's tax returns, Trump seems to go to court to fight that, and we have not seen that happening yet. It's a little unclear to me why she wouldn't have sought the tax returns. And it's possible that that is one of the things she has subpoenaed from the Trump Organization, and the Trump Organization is now refusing to turn over. I mean, getting the tax returns is essential because it could provide crucial evidence as to whether Trump has accurately and properly disclosed the true state of his finance to tax authorities and to the government and at the state or federal level.
David Enrich is the business investigations editor at the New York Times and the author of Dark Towers, which explores Donald Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In response to a request for comment, a Trump Organization spokesperson told The Takeaway, quote, "The NYAG's continued harassment of the company as we approach the election and filing of this motion on the first day of the Republican National Convention once again confirms that this investigation is all about politics." You can read the full statement online at thetakeaway.org. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.